Dan Crary, the devil, played the fiddle, and Jeff White with the fiddle in the trees. You know, boys and girls, friends, neighbors, I could stand right here and do this all the live long day, but now, around about now, sort of overwhelming force takes over, happens in my life sometimes. Yeah, it's time to head on down that old Catfish Highway. Thanks to Julie and Dave for coming in and talking to us about the Bluegrass Association Jamboree coming up tomorrow. And thanks to Elliot, and thanks to Lacey for taking care of all of our telephone communications. Y'all have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you on down the road. Bye-bye.
BBC News. Hello. Huge disruption to international air travel is set to ease after London Heathrow Airport said some flights will resume later today as electricity is restored following a complete blackout. The International Airlines Organisation said the electricity substation fire that caused the closure raised serious questions about why Heathrow was dependent on a single power source. More than 200,000 passengers were affected. Rich Preston is at Heathrow.
Lots of people will be breathing a huge sigh of relief at this news. Now, they do stress they're going to be prioritising repatriating and relocating aircraft. Interesting lines coming from some of the airlines themselves, though. United Airlines are saying it expects to be able to leave the United States later and land at Heathrow on Saturday morning. An Air Canada spokesperson saying Heathrow is reopening. We plan to operate our regular schedule of flights starting Friday evening.
Crowds have gathered outside Istanbul Town Hall for the third night to protest against the detention of the popular mayor of Turkey's biggest city. They say the arrest of Ekrem İmamoğlu is politically motivated. Emily Wither reports.
Protesters, mostly students, gathered on the streets of Istanbul for a third day, chanting "Government resign." Despite a heavy police presence and a warning directly from President Erdogan that the demonstrations are street terrorism, crowds continue to build in towns and cities across Turkey. The warning comes after the leader of the opposition called for people to take to the streets, following the detention of the party's preferred presidential candidate and popular mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu.
Sudan's army has strengthened its position in the capital, Khartoum, after its capture of the presidential palace from the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Though some RSF units remain in the city, its presence is greatly diminished. Videos on social media showed army soldiers celebrating inside the palace. Israel has continued to attack targets in Gaza, with its defense minister threatening to permanently occupy parts of the territory if Hamas refuses to release its remaining hostages. Israel Katz said the longer the militants held out, the more land would be seized. The acting U.S. ambassador to the UN told the Security Council that Hamas was to blame for all the deaths since Israel renewed its offensive on Tuesday. Here's Emir Nader.
There has been a real fierce storm over the past couple of days lashing the Gaza Strip, and UN officials have confirmed to us that since Israel blocked all aid entering into Gaza at the beginning of March, this is now the longest period of time since the beginning of the war where no aid has been able to enter the Gaza Strip. The local ambulance service there, the Palestinian Red Cross, saying around half of its ambulances aren't functional because there is no fuel. And now these very strong statements from the Minister of Defence.
World News from the BBC. Israel's Attorney General has prohibited Benjamin Netanyahu from appointing a new head of the Domestic Intelligence Service. Gali Maharav Miara said the Prime Minister would have to wait until the Supreme Court makes a final ruling on the fate of the head of the Shin Bet, Ronan Bar, who was sacked last night. Under Mr. Bar, Shin Bet has been probing claims that top aides of the Prime Minister were lobbying on behalf of Qatar. President Trump has awarded the contract to build a next-generation fighter jet to the Boeing Corporation. He said experimental versions of the plane, named the F-47, had been flying secretly for 5 years. Mr. Trump said it was equipped with advanced stealth technology, as well as the ability to cooperate with swarms of drones. One of the most important Western spies of the Cold War, Oleg Gordievsky, has died at the age of 86 at his home in England. He worked secretly for Britain's intelligence service, MI6, for 11 years while he was employed by the Soviet KGB and handed over a vast trove of secret information. He was credited with changing the course of the Cold War by helping the West understand the Soviet perspective. Gordievsky was recalled to Moscow in 1985 but was smuggled back to Britain. Britain and Austrian researchers say birds in the Galapagos Islands became more aggressive when exposed to noise from vehicles. The study looked at Galapagos yellow warblers. They found the male birds showed more physically aggressive behaviour towards intruders when they were closer to noise pollution. Dr. Charla Akai helped write the report.
When birds are experiencing a noisy environment, they literally may not be heard because their songs are at risk of being masked by this traffic noise. And if they can't be heard, their signals can't go across, then they might have to actually resort to physical aggression to defend their territories.
That's the latest BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
It's 12:06. You're listening to WORT Downtown Madison. My name is Carlos Davalos. You're listening to A Public Affair. The phone number, I'm sorry, 608-256-2001. And we will have today a fascinating conversation about weather. My two guests today are Dr. Angel Adames Corraliza and Dr. Mayra Oyola. Both are faculty members of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences here at UW-Madison. Both are also from Puerto Rico. Both had their BS from physics, from the University of Puerto Rico, Mayagüez. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. There are a lot of questions. We usually take for granted the weather and everything that it's around it, but there are so many things that we can talk about: weather systems, tropical latitudes, I'm going to call them, the time. And we should start by understanding. Let me ask, how are time systems organized? Tropical versus north, weather sections, regions. How can we understand the weather before going into more detailed questions?
Sure. So we can essentially think about our planet, right? We have one atmosphere, but the weather systems and the patterns that affect weather and climate actually change regionally. And one of the ways that we see the biggest changes is by latitude. So latitudes like north and south, right? So near the equator, so we have the tropical latitudes. This is the area that receives the most amount of sunshine on Earth. And because of that, these latitudes tend to be warmer. In association with that, we have more humidity. And so we get weather systems that are like, we have thunderstorms, really heavy rain in some areas. Some other areas are actually really dry. You got deserts. And you got a variety of phenomena that are considered tropical, right? For example, a hurricane, you know, in our regions are considered a type of tropical phenomenon. We also have monsoons, right? Like they don't necessarily affect mostly affect the southwest U.S. They have a monsoon, but the biggest monsoons are usually in Asia. So we don't hear that as much in where we live. In comparison, we have in the middle latitudes, so this is where we live. The middle latitudes is like roughly from 30 to 60 degrees north and south. So this is where the U.S. is located. Most of Canada is as well. And here we get mostly weather systems in the form of mid-latitude storms. So we've been having a you know, a train of them come back to back this week, you know. So they're the systems that affect our day-to-day lives the most. In association with these systems, we have what we call cold fronts and warm fronts. So mid-latitude weather systems are usually associated with big changes in temperature. In association with these changes in temperature, we got rain, snow, other forms of, you know, cloudiness and other forms of inclement weather, which we do not see in the tropics. In the tropics, temperatures do not change very much at all.
Dr. Mayra Oyola, how do we understand, for example, that in places like Wisconsin versus other regions in more southern areas have much more marked weather seasons, you know, the four seasons of the year? How can we understand that here we have all those, and then in Mexico, for example, where I'm from, mm-hmm. we do not have those?
That is an excellent question. And as a matter of fact, from me coming from the tropics, that was very very exciting experience to live through the seasons. And it all has to do with the inclination of our planet. So the planet is not straight, it's inclined relative to the sun. So we are at an inclination of about 23 degrees. And it's because this inclination that the tropics normally sees the same amount of solar radiation throughout the year, while the subtropics, either in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere, see different kind of amounts of solar insolation throughout the year. And it is this solar insolation that will actually provide the necessary energy to drive summer versus fall versus winter.
That's fascinating, I think. And how do we understand, for example, that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like here in Wisconsin, for example, in Madison, we're getting less and less snow. Mm-hmm. Is that correct to frame like that?
It depends on the year, but yeah.
Yeah, so it like Meyer says, it does depend on the year. There's a lot of year-to-year variation. So some years are going to be a lot more snowier than other years. That's just kind of how it goes, you know, like especially in the middle latitudes, which tend to be very chaotic. So every year from one to the next is can be very different. However, you know, we are seeing a pattern in which we are moving into warmer temperatures in the winter, and the winter is becoming shorter. And the temperatures over winter are a little higher, and that also is causing for what would sometimes come as snow will be coming in as rain, yeah, just because of these temperature changes, and that's related to anthropogenic climate change.
Yeah, I would say we will receive either similar or larger amounts of precipitation. They just don't come in snow form, which obviously they have some impact on the environment around Wisconsin.
Let me throw in the human activity variable. How has that changed what you just explained to us? Is human activity responsible for these changes?
We've seen some signals of climate change, which is associated with human activity, yes.
And is there a way to scale back this patterns that we are that you just explained to us?
There are ways. The timing, it's I would say, is of essence. And
it's like the last call, like they say in the bar.
Yes, would say definitely.
Yeah, and it's a very tricky question because there is a reality that we're facing that, like, we could, like, do, right? So there's no question that human activity is rapidly changing our climate in a way that has never been seen before. And even if we do aggressive measures like right now, the climate is going to continue to change for decades. Mm-hmm. And that has to do a lot with like the what we call the inertia of the planet, and the fact that a lot of the energy that we are, you know, that a lot of that heat that's getting trapped by, from the fact of human activity, that a lot of that is going into the ocean. And the ocean is a very slow responder. Yeah. So even if we make big changes now, we're still going to see a lot of warming in the future.
As experts, expert meteorologists, what are direct suggestions, I guess, for people listening, for people that are worried about this, that it's, you know, it's something that I think should be a priority for absolutely everyone. Mm-hmm. But it seems that it's not yet in that, it doesn't have that position yet. What are straight clear suggestions for people right now?
I think we need to have changes that are more long-term than short-term solutions. And I think I wanted to connect back with what Angela was saying previously. We had a period of, I would say, slowed down in normal human activity during COVID. So for almost a year, we saw reductions in many of the trace gases that are present in the atmosphere. And yet, we didn't see much of a change after COVID. So when it comes to the things that we can do, I think as a society, we need to think about long-term changes. An example is policy and international policy. And we have a perfect example of a success in policy with the ozone layer. Someone detected the ozone layer decades ago. Many countries identified it as a problem. All of these countries got together and passed laws locally and internationally that prevented more of these types of gases in the atmosphere. And we've seen a reduction on the ozone hole. And it seems that if we continue on track, we should be able to go back to pre-industrial levels in a couple of decades from now. So that's a long-term successful response to a climate-related problem. Can we do the same with climate change? I believe so.
So there's hope.
There is hope. I think that there needs to be aggressive and definitive action taken. Like Mayra is saying, I think a lot of it has to come from the legislative level. It has to be large scale. I think as individuals, people can do their part. You know, you can, you know, reduce the, you know, like do carpooling. You know, you can commute by bike. You can, you know, like be more cognizant about how much power you use. But that can only go so far without there being like large scale mandates about how we're using our energy. And the reality is that like if we want to like see things change significantly, we have to, you know, move towards renewable energies at a fast pace. We need to fund research in renewable energy. Right now, for example, there is a lot of promise in fusion. I'm not an expert on it, so I can't comment much on it, but I've been hearing more and more about breakthroughs in fusion as an alternative energy source. In addition to that, I think the conversation about carbon sequestration is gaining momentum, and I think it probably needs to happen as well. And also, like, there has to be, and we can go into more of that, but international coordination about who gets, you know, does X or Y, that also needs to happen as well. But it has to be aggressive and it has to be soon.
Later in the hour, I'm going to ask both of you about the political influence that the weather can have, whether positive or negative. Before that, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Dr. Angel Adames Corraliza and Dr. Mayra Oyola, I'm sorry, both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences here at UW-Madison. Let me, and by the way, phone number here in the studio is 608-256-2001. Let me go into a different topic. Can we talk about how historically, you know, this science has been structured, how it started? Some weeks ago when I met Angel, we talked about how, I'm going to say, ancient or, you know, previous civilizations like Aztec or Inca or Taino had, you know, already really sophisticated systems and knowledge to understand weather. Can we talk a little about what that was lost, how the idea of colonization had an impact on how we understand weather today?
Sure. So like I mentioned to you in the conversation when we talked about a couple of weeks ago, a lot of what we refer to as modern atmospheric science in meteorology, even climate science, is very Western-centric. So a lot of the ideas that have kind of taken, you know, a foothold and are kind of like the you know, what we discuss do come largely from Europe and the United States and scientists, several key scientists from these institutions. And there have been really important players, especially in what I do, tropical meteorology, which is what I can speak to the most, there have been important contributions from Japan, China, India that are increasingly getting recognized nowadays, but have been kind of been left on the wayside. So that's one conversation topic. The other conversation topic is that a lot of indigenous populations, why they didn't have, you know, the way that we do science right now, right? The scientific method, these are all Western ideas. But that doesn't mean that indigenous populations didn't have knowledge about the natural world. And for example, one of the conversations that we had was we knew that, for example, the Taino, which is the Caribbean indigenous population, they knew, and of course, this is relevant for their well-being, right? Puerto Rico, for example, is a tropical island. The weather is pretty steady on a day-to-day basis, except for a dry versus wet season. But we do get tropical cycles. We get hurricanes, right? And the Taino knew about hurricanes. And we know that because they had their deities, right? And one of the deities, the Semí, we had Huracán. And the Semí, which is their kind of symbol, had a spiral shape. So you can surmise just by looking at that the Taíno knew, Huracán, hurricane, that's, the name Huracán, that's where the name hurricane comes from. And so just by looking at the spiral arms, it literally is a face with spiral arms, which, if you see a tropical cyclone, you see that it has spiral bands of rainfall. And it has a center eye, right? The face. So you can easily surmise that the Taino knew that hurricanes were cyclonic circulations with air flowing around a center, possibly with spiral bands of rainfall associated with them as well. Same, we have a colleague, Victor, who comes from South America. We can talk about the knowledge that the South American natives had about El Nino and how that impact their agriculture. So they knew about the southern oscillation way before El Nino, southern oscillation, way before it became a major topic of discussion in southern societies. Unfortunately, all that knowledge got lost because the Spanish came, right? And then colonization happened. And these populations got decimated. A lot of their not necessarily writing, but a lot of their things that were documented, they got burned, they got destroyed. And so there's no way to know to what extent they knew about phenomena. And I think because of that and the subsequent colonial treatment of the tropical nations, right, you can't, it's really difficult to argue against the reason why, for example, the meteorology of the mid-latitudes is much more advanced and well understood than the meteorology of the tropics. And you can account that to, a lot of these ideas are Westerns. These are people that come from the middle latitudes. They advance these ideas, but then the tropical phenomena, they became of more interest for people from higher latitudes in World War II or later on. So there is a time lag between knowledge advancing one location and another, and colonialism has a lot to do with that.
For the people that are interested in seeing that image that you just explained to us, how do you spell the name of that hurricane deity from the Taino people?
Huracán. So it's J-U-R-A-C-A-N. So for almost hurricane.
Like hurricane, but I guess in Spanish, that's how you say huracán, no?
Yeah.
For people interested, it's really fascinating to see the image because it's something that is really, really old. And in just a little image, you can understand what they were talking about. Dr. Mayra, is there anything you can add to that in terms of the historical structure of this science?
Yes, I think Angel explained really well what's happening in the tropics, but it obviously spans outside of the tropics as well. If you look at every weather forecast or the outputs of weather forecasts around the world, you'll see that most of the accuracy happens near developed countries or regions. When you try to look at forecast in other regions, for example, the African continent, they may not be as great. And there's a reason for that that stems from colonialism. So we have our major weather centers are all in the northern hemisphere. So for example, here in the U.S., we have the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which has the National Weather Service. In Europe, we have the European Center for Medium Range Forecasting, or ECMWF. So they get all this big funding and they have ability to deploy instruments on land, at sea, on space that are not necessarily accessible in other countries that are developing. So we see this issue in particular, again, Africa, South America, and other areas of the world that may not have the same amount of resources.
Before going in on the air, I learned that you are an expert on satellites. Is that? I think that's what you said. Can you explain also in historical terms how that was established, how that started?
That's a great story. As a matter of fact, in terms of satellite, I specialize on meteorological satellites, so atmospheric science satellites. There's a reason why I got brought to Wisconsin and I wanted to work from here, and is that our department is actually the birthplace of satellite meteorology for the world. So again, there's a lot of great stuff happening here in Wisconsin that stems from that. But at the same time, obviously, Wisconsin sits in the U.S., which is a developed country. So there's a lot of more access to that type of data in this side of the world and even in the Northern Hemisphere compared to other places. But yes, satellites, going back into the satellite world, it's a really powerful tool. And actually, it's becoming a lot more accessible. So there are all of these initiatives trying to make satellite data and satellite visualizations accessible to all communities around the world. So in a way, it's a positive tool that we have in order to kind of close these gaps developed by colonialism in academia and in research and in weather.
Let me ask you this. What is the impact on daily life, on regular people, regular citizens, of satellite data? What can people know about this that it's having an effect on our daily lives?
Yes, huge. So if you think about, I'm looking at my phone and my watch, you think about GPS. GPS is based on satellite technology. And actually, there are techniques derived from GPS that we applied on our weather forecasting world. So if you look at GPS as a whole, just for communications, you'll see that it drives the economy of this country and the world. So right there in terms of economy, it's huge. And as I said, there are applications stemming in the weather forecasting world where now we have additional data about different layers of the atmosphere in terms of temperature, pressure, relative humidity, and those things combined can provide a bigger picture of what's happening. Traditionally, we get, you can think about satellites in many ways. You can think of them as just taking a snapshot of what's happening on Earth. And many times for us, we focus on our region, but we don't think outside of what's happening outside of our region, right? But that's how we actually monitor the systems that are approaching and other systems that are developing nearby. And they're technically the backbone of our numerical weather prediction systems. So they're an incredible, powerful tool for weather and forecasting, not only because we're able to visualize, but the data itself goes into models, our weather models that are run across the world. And without satellites, our forecasting ability was actually pretty poor. So it has improved, especially after the 90s, because of the ingestion of satellite data in models.
Would it be correct to say that now, after the 90s, like you just said, the satellite data, which I'm guessing we can call, it's under the umbrella of natural resources, correct?
It will be under the umbrella of many things, but it definitely impacts how we protect and how we forecast things related to natural resources. So I'm mentioning weather because it's the one thing that it's close dear to my heart, but there are other things, for example, landscape use, ocean, communications, commerce, you name it. Like pretty much everything that we do nowadays is influenced by the presence of satellite data.
I'm thinking now about the global power dynamics that go into this and the interests that different countries, different regions have in controlling this data and having a hand in what it's out and what's not out. Can you both talk about this and how the power dynamic in politics mainly has influenced the data in general, not only satellite data, but also climate data?
Well, globally, there are organizations around the world, particularly I can mention the United Nations because I've worked with them before, where they have to, they're trying to make these data sets not only accessible to different groups, but easier to access. So satellite data, you kind of need to be an expert if you are going into the very nitty-gritty details of dealing with satellite. It's very complicated. There's this whole theory that actually stems from astronomy as to how you do what we call satellite retrieval data and all this. But ultimately, you have your decision makers and you have people that work in emergency management and people that want to make decisions about agriculture and their way of life. So many organizations across the world have taken the task of improving the visualization and the accessibility of these data sets. And there are many, I would say many, efforts around the world in terms of this, what we call open science, open data, where these data sets are now easier to access, easier to visualize, but also more accessible. And that's important for developing countries because they may not have the satellite expertise in terms of having a professor or an engineer that does this work. But if they can access the data and they learn, they know how to interpret it, now you're giving them an advantage. And of course, for us, it's the same thing. I'm talking about developing countries, but it's the same thing for any country in the world. So every government, especially United States, in the last, I would say probably 10 years, if not longer, they have made humongous efforts into making these data sets shared, accessible, open to the community. And there's a lot of collaboration, international peaceful, we call it peacetime use of satellite data. So there's a lot of that happening, at least up to this point. We are one of the many countries that actually develop and deploy satellites. And of course, the richer countries, the more the capability. And now we also have the private sector doing a lot of these satellite launches. So there's a lot of power dynamics in different sectors that may influence the development and also the accessibility to these data sets.
Angel, is there anything you want to add to that?
Sure. So one of the reasons why I was traveling for the last couple of weeks, I was out in East Asia. So I was in South Korea and then I was in Thailand. And one of the reason why I was doing this trip was because these, especially Thailand, which is a developing nation, they're really interested in using satellite data in conjunction with artificial intelligence to create better models for their own. So like Mayan and I were talking earlier, like the forecast models are better in developed nations where the models are developed. Part of it is the observation network is more dense, right? And so you get better forecasts in that region. Also, the physics of those models are built for those latitudes and for those regions. And so the people that live well outside of the development, they don't get as good forecasts as we talked earlier. However, as Mayra mentioned, like satellite data levels the playing field a little bit, right? Especially free open access satellite data. So these nations are actually interested in using that data so they can develop their own forecast model based on artificial intelligence, which we can talk some other time, right? There's a lot of going on in there. But the gist of it is that it makes forecasting a lot easier because this, the computing power is actually much less for those type of models than the big models that we run in the U.S. and in Europe. And so there's now a big, I would say, transformation going on in developing nations where all these nations are starting to, you know, develop these types of tools for their own benefit because they need, you know, they can't just rely on data that's coming from the outside. They need their own tools to improve their forecast. And a lot of these countries live very far away and don't necessarily have the observational network. So generally, as Mayer says, it is like a level playing field. But the point that I wanted to add is that this open data framework, in addition to like everything that's going on with artificial intelligence, this is transforming the field, especially for those nations. It is happening very fast.
This is a fascinating conversation. If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Dr. Ángel Adames Corraliza and Dr. Mayra Oyola, both from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. You're listening to Public Affair. This is WORT 89.9. We're broadcasting from downtown Madison, Wisconsin. And the phone number, if you have a question for them, is 608-256-2001. I have another question, talking about the world order and how there are some decision makers that are that have, I guess, a lot more power. What are some priorities in terms of the weather systems that have not been put on the list or put, you know, up there because they are coming from places that do not have the resources or do not have the power? What are some, you know, time and climate really, really important issues that are being left behind?
Oh boy, this is a packed question. So there's definitely so generally, you know, because a lot of the developed nations are at higher latitudes in general, like there is a large priority on to just like the weather systems that affect here. A lot of the, for example, tropical phenomena, again, this is what I study, that have gotten the interest of people that live here is because they have some kind of direct or indirect impact on weather here. So things like El Niño, for example, we know, for example, that El Niño has a big impact on temperatures and precipitation patterns. That's well documented. However, that's not for people that live outside of the Northern Hemisphere middle latitudes. There's a lot more going on. I would argue that there's a couple things that are quite important that I don't necessarily have gotten the due attention. I will mention two. One is how the ocean is changing and how that is impacting local populations around the globe. We do hear a lot here in the United States. There we are hearing a lot more about the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or the AMOC. That is an important topic, right? But it does affect largely the North America and Europe. That's where the impacts are. That's not the only major oceanic circulation that has impacts on lives around the world. The Indian Ocean, for example, has some really, really important currents that are changing as well. And then the Southern Ocean. I have not seen the level of attention. These populations, the people in these regions really care about what's going on in these regions. Not just on how it's changing with climate change, but how agriculture, you know, like the like runoff of like river discharge, how that's changing the oceans. And that is especially of concern for people in Southeast Asia, because they actually, their livelihood often comes from like fisheries. So they a lot of their meals is essentially from fish and other marine animals. And so they're really highly impacted by changes in the ocean. So that's one. A second one that does have the attention of academics, but not necessarily like absolutely everybody, is land use and deforestation. And that does have an impact in the middle latitudes, but it turns out that the biggest impacts are actually out near the boreal forest out in the higher latitudes. So like those are getting impacted by fires, and there's a lot going on in there. But also tropical rainforests, which have some of the highest biodiversity on Earth. For example, South American scientists are really worried about the Amazon rainforest. The Amazon is probably the most important geographical feature of South America, in addition to the Andes. And how the Amazon is changing is going to have a big impact to the livelihood of people there. And there is a worry that the rainforest might collapse at some point in the future.
That sounds really extreme and tragic and just really sad.
Right. And so I don't think it has necessarily the big attention of people at higher latitudes, but people in Latin America are very concerned about that. But I think those are two topics that I think don't necessarily have as much interest right now. It might change in the future, as I think more people start realizing the big impacts that those are causing.
Thank you for that really detailed answer. Maida, is there anything you want to add? What are priorities that should be on the top of the list and are not, because they're not coming from places of power, places with resources?
Yeah, I would say one of them actually is part of my area of research, and that will be aerosols. People, when they think about aerosols, they think about a spray can. But in reality, these are particles that are suspended in the atmosphere. They're very small, but you need them for precipitation. They're a natural part of the precipitation process and the cloud formation process. But aerosols actually come out of from many flavors and from different sources. Some of them anthropogenic, which are man-made. Others are natural, like land. Land use, you can get dust. You can get sea salt from the oceans and all of these things. But specifically now, because of the increase in wildfire activity, that's an aerosol. So when you have these big wildfires, you're basically releasing a huge amount of aerosols in the atmosphere. And there's some impacts associated with health that actually are very in tune with the UN priorities in terms of everybody, you know, living and having a healthy life. But not only that, there's another aspect of aerosol impact, which is these aerosols are actually able to change weather patterns in different places. So they don't stay in one place. They're in the air moves, it's a fluid. So as these air masses move, you can change patterns in other places. So I think that's an important topic, especially with the amount of wildfire activity that we're getting, not only in the US, but if you look around the world, the entire globe is getting a significant amount of wildfire events that that continue to rise over the years, and very, very volatile wildfire seasons.
Thank you. If you're just tuning in, again, my guests today are Dr. Angel Adames Corraliza and Dr. Mayra Oyola, both from the UW-Madison. The phone number that we have is 608-256-2001. Right before we went into the air, our amazing producer, Sarah Gabler, told us not to swear, so I'm not going to swear because we're going now into the Gulf of Mexico conversation. You know, listening to the radio shows in the United States and Mexico, it's framed usually as just a symbol, you know, just a name that is not going to change in Mexico, just like the Rio Bravo and Rio Grande have different names, but, you know, depending on what side or the border you're standing. But from the meteorologist perspective, from your expertise, from your field, how can it change like this impact weather and time reading? Can you please talk about this recent change? And by the way, I think the Gulf of Mexico, the name was established in the 1600s, like centuries ago. So can you share about your thoughts about this?
Sure. So my main concern about this change is essentially what will, maybe I can call the politicization of weather and for our field, specifically the politicization of weather and the information that gets sent across the public, because I can easily see, and of course this is like my opinion, you know, we have yet to see how this impacts, but you can see how, depending on what your political inclination is, how whether a forecast gets brought to a person, how that they'll impact that credibility that person is going to ascribe to the forecast. So and the Gulf of Mexico is actually a weather and climate phenomena extremely important for the U.S. So a lot of the weather patterns that affect not just the adjacent states, but everything up to Wisconsin, a lot of phenomena come from the Gulf of Mexico. Big rain events, even in Wisconsin, often are from moisture surges from the Gulf of Mexico. It is an extremely source of weather. Of course, we also have hurricanes that traverse the Gulf of Mexico. Sometimes severe storm outbreaks are associated with moisture from the Gulf of Mexico. So we're talking about, like, when you make a list of what are the most important geographical features for, like, weather phenomena in the United States, the Gulf of Mexico is high up there, if not the highest of importance. I'm worried that if somebody, say that you're somebody on TV or you're somebody on an app and you're saying there's a storm coming and it's going through the Gulf of Mexico, that somebody with a different political leaning is actually not going to take it as seriously because it doesn't say Gulf of America or vice versa, you know? And so I worry that like these changes actually affect how people digest the information, the people that are on the other side digest the information. And that's, I think, the concern is that because then ultimately that does affect the well-being and the safety of people. And I don't know how that's going to ultimately impact everything, but I am concerned that that's going to politicize, because then that information, then the person who's giving the information then gets some political leaning ascribed to them as well. So I worry that it's going to cause divide in not just the people that are receiving the information, but the people that are receiving the information, they're going to like label the people that are giving the information as, this is the person who I should trust because it's saying the things that I believe versus the other person. And we already have issues like this in our field, so it wouldn't be the first time, but it's yet another example of things that worry me about how people receiving information get impacted by naming conventions.
What are other examples of something similar?
I mean, there's so many things related to climate change, you know, like the politicization of climate change and how that is described in the public. You know, like if you talk about like climate change, you know, and for example, like you say, you know, in the past, global warming, you know, what's the word that we were using, right? And it became a discussion item, and you know, people that, you know, it became to such a point that like there was a political separation between the people that accepted climate change as a fact that it's happening versus the people that don't. And climate change is happening, whether you believe it in it or not. You know, like it doesn't matter whether you believe in climate change or not. Climate change is happening, you know. But the concern is that, again, it's become a political issue, and that people that have a certain view of the world don't believe necessarily that it's happening because their base has told them that that is a lie. And that is a similar, you know, like I think the climate change is even bigger concern than the Gulf of America and Mexico issue for sure. But it is on the similar vein of concern that it is going to politicize weather in the area and for the people that get affected by it.
Maida, from your perspective, from your field of expertise, what is the impact of this change, Gulf of Mexico versus Gulf of America?
I would go a little bit farther than that. I would say politicization of agencies that provide the absolutely best service in terms of forecasting. And one of them is the National Weather Service and the National Hurricane Center. So now if you go to the National Hurricane Center, you see that distinction. So the first thing when you go to the website is a map of the tropics that now says Gulf of America. And so the problem with using politics around products like this, again, as Angel mentioned, it would be the reception that the public gets. Particularly in the case of NOAA, and we have experienced this in the past, sometimes people question the forecast, even though NOAA's forecast is the absolute best forecast that you can get. Sometimes I hear people saying, well, the TV forecaster said X, Y, or Z, without realizing that the data and the actual forecast that the TV meteorologist is most likely telling you or giving you comes from NOAA. Same thing, they talk about so-and-so's product, so you use an app, and they mention one app is better than another app or better than the government, but in reality, the products that those apps are using are actually NOAA's products. So it is a danger. I think we're endangering society and the information that we're trying to give to protect life and property by heavily putting these agencies under this heavy political agenda. And I'm worried about hurricane season. And that's me, my personal opinion. I'm worried about severe season here now that started in the Midwest, especially because some of the offices have actually lost lease and personnel. So we don't know what that is going to be in terms of the forecast locally for severe weather, for tornadoes and hail and all these things that we experience. And likewise, what's going to happen during hurricane season.
I have a question about tornadoes precisely in hurricane season. We're maybe going to go into hypotheticals. But what could be a danger for people that are in this sections of the country or the continent if this information gets politicized to that extreme?
I would expect that websites that normally have information that are accessible by everyone are not going to be updated or are not going to provide the information that the public needs, and that people start making wrong decisions because they don't have the right information. So that's that's always been a concern, how people interpret, and agencies like NOAA and the National Weather Service for the past 10 or 20 years, they put a lot of effort, not only working with forecasters, scientists, professors, but also working with social scientists in better communicating the products that they develop so people can actually interpret and make a decision that may protect their life and property. So that's my biggest concern, that now that information may not be as accessible as it should be, and perhaps people will reach out to other sources of information that may not be the most accurate.
100% agree. And in addition to that, I do think that how people receive that information, like it will, like the accessibility affects it, and then how people on the receiving end interpret that, because they don't necessarily will interpret it as like, this is no longer accessible because it is no longer accessible. Like some people may interpret it as like, they no longer want to give me this information, or like this, you know, I can't trust X organization or Y organization. And so I think that that's going to lead for people to, like, you know, not have access to information, and some other information might be completely disregarded as well by some people. And that is a extreme concern and extreme danger as well, because we already face dangers in general from weather every year. You know, tornado season every year, big problem in the U.S., hurricane season as well. In fact, what we were just talking about, the Gulf of Mexico, like the worst hurricanes that hit the U.S. are usually Gulf storms. That is, you know, a fact. You look at a list of the deadliest hurricanes, almost all of them are Gulf hurricanes. So, and it worries me that, like, where we're heading will lead to more fatalities and this and loss of life in because of what's happening in the current climate, political climate.
We are in the last 10 minutes of public affairs. I'm your host for today, Carlos Dávalos, and I have two amazing guests, Dr. Ángel Adames Corraliza and Dr. Mayra Oyola. Let me remind everyone outside, the phone number that we have in the studio is 608-256-2001. There's still some time for questions. Mayra, a few minutes ago you said that at some point, maybe this has changed, at some point the U.S. shared and had a lot of data and information that was available for everyone. Has this changed? Where should people go if they are interested in reliable weather information?
We still have a lot of these websites available. And again, a lot of the big federal agencies across the United States have put a lot of effort on developing these data sets and making them available to the public. One big one I'm going to give a big shout out to, it's NASA, National Atmospheric and Space Administration. NASA, my former employer, I love them, love working there, great science, but they also have a fantastic number of websites with fantastic resources, from educational outreach, data that can be used for visualization, can be used for emergency managers to make decisions. So they've done a lot of work in doing what they call Earth Action, which is basically connecting our science to the public. NOAA, another big, huge agency that likewise has a number of offices, a number of National Weather Service offices across the United States, and also has other offices like the Storm Prediction Center, their modeling centers, which are in the Northeast in Silver Spring, Maryland. So they have a lot of resources available for the public. They have graphic forecasts. They have our daily forecast. We can even look at hourly forecasts on these websites. And not only we have those forecasts, that actually drives our education, because we can use that data that they produce to continue doing the research that we do as well. So there's a lot of interconnectivity in terms of accessibility and also the what gets out of these data sets and how we use them.
So to quickly add, so if anybody that's listening wants to get their forecast from NOAA, from National Weather Service, go to weather.gov, and you can just, when you get to that page, you can just put the name of the city where you live, and it'll like immediately take you to the local forecast, and they'll have a bunch of products, including graphical products. You can click, It'll give you a time series of the forecast, the wind, humidity, rainfall probability, all those things are in those in that page. I repeat, go to weather.gov. So instead of com, which is the weather channel, gov, the G-O-V, which gives you to the National Weather Service.
One of my last questions is the following, and please correct me if I'm framing this wrong, but the current administration just cut Catherine Calvin, chief scientist of the NASA, no, the link between NASA and the White House. Besides this change and maybe others, what is the impact, what is the consequence of making these political decisions in terms of weather? How can you explain the decisions that, and maybe budget cuts too, that the current administration is enforcing into these agencies?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And that's a very sad example because that office, the Office of the Chief Scientist, they are the linchpin. They connect the scientists and the leaders at NOAA, at NASA, actually with Congress. So that was very unfortunate. And also that office does what we call inclusive excellence. So all the efforts to have a more diverse, which diversity has been under attack. But in reality, if you're going to have good products and good science and good development, you need to have a diverse workforce. So all of that went away when that office went away. So we can definitely, we'll expect to see some impacts in terms of a lot of the policy that office was doing. In terms of the National Weather Service, again, there were forecasters that were let go. I correct me if I'm wrong, but it was about 1,200 people that got fired, a lot of them in critical positions that had to do with emitting forecasts that protect life and property. So this is where it gets scary because we don't know what the impact of that's going to be, but we're about to start two very critical weather seasons. Severe weather and hurricane. So
I see your faces and your faces look worried right now, suddenly changed. What in terms of information has any of these decisions, will any of these decisions impact the actual information that will come out of these agencies?
I mean, the you know, the messaging is changing. They're being told to message in a certain way, and that is worrisome. To be honest, I'm not sure what the impact is going to be. There will be an impact. We know that. You know, the extent of it. You know, how it degrades the quality of the products that people receive. I'm not 100% sure of what it will be, but it will have an impact. And I think that, unfortunately, yet this is just the start of it. I don't think that the layoffs that we just seen are the only thing that's going to be happening. And we are seeing people that lost their jobs that are, you know, all the way up to the National Hurricane Center. So people that are like lead hurricane forecasters that just got promoted or got fired. And so these are the people who are best equipped to discuss what is going on with hurricanes, losing their jobs.
Makes me think immediately of the private sector. Is there any private agency that could maybe substitute or replace all the amazing work that these government agencies have provided for so many years?
So I can start, and then Mayra can add because she does have a lot of more experience than I do on this. And this is based on the conversations that I have with Mayra. Almost all the private agencies, their products, everything that they develop, they use data from NOAA and the National Weather Service. Essentially, like the base product that everybody uses are the products that NOAA has. And for example, like the global forecast systems, which is the global model that we use, that's done by NOAA. So everybody's just using data from NOAA. So I don't think there is like a real replacement from NOAA. Everybody just uses data from NOAA.
We're going to have to stop here. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation. I have to thank our engineer today, Summer, and Lamia, receptionist today. Of course, Sarah Gabler and Shally Pittman, director of news at WORT. My name is Carlos Davalos, and thank you so much for listening. Till the next time.
precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Mel and Floyd.
We come and listen and support it.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got a year. Wow! I feel nice. The sugar runs by. I feel nice. A sugar and spice. So nice, so nice. I got you.
When I hold you. Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel.
And he's Floyd.
Floyd's here.
I'm here.
Yay. Mr. Smarty Pants is off this week. He's in Vienna.
Oh, he is?
Yes.
Getting the little sausages?
He's getting a whole bunch of the little sausages before they put the tariffs on.
Right, that's so. The thing. Those little sausages are going to be pretty darn expensive after they get the tariffs.
Because they're made with, like, aluminum and avocado, I think.
Right, right.
I'm not sure what's in those things. But
I think there's maw.
What?
And maw. Pork maw. Yeah. And anus, probably.
Maw. Sweepings.
Yes. I think that's natural flavorings.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.